30 years ago as a lost soul, but somehow or another Krishna directed me in the door. Actually, I remember that the first time I came here, I was with three other people. I can't remember the names. I don't think any of them became devotees. But I remember one chap. He was from he was Welsh, from Wales. That was before we had our centres in Swansea and Cardiff. And I think the main attraction, if I remember correctly, I think the main attraction was that there was a sign in the window that there was some free food available. And we were young, kind of teenagers, early 20s, and unemployed, and we had no money. So when we saw free food, we thought, wow, that sounds attractive or looks attractive. So the Welsh chap, there's four of us, the Welsh chap, just as we were coming across the threshold of the door, the Welsh chap said, there must be a catch. Free food, there must be a catch. And 30 years later, I can agree with him. There was a wonderful catch. And the catch was that you become part of Krishna's family. Of course, everybody's part of Krishna's family anyway. But you become a more intimate member of Krishna's family by honoring prasadam, by chanting Hare Krishna, by engaging in devotional service, and by associating with all of those wonderful personalities who also chant Hare Krishna. So that Welsh chap that day, he didn't cross the threshold. He actually decided not to come in. But by Krishna's mercy, somehow or another, I decided that I would come in. I was given that free plate of prasadam, and I've never looked back. Yeah, that was 30 years ago. That was 1981, I think. Amazing. Okay, so now we'll do something very unusual. We will chant Hare Krishna. Who said this is the Big Ben of microphones? I guess we need the Big Ben of microphones for this big room. You look like the Big Ben of microphone stand tighteners. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, Krishna.
Hare Hare Hare. Mama.
Krishna. Krishna Sankirtan Ki, Srila Prabhupada Ki. Okay, so I thought I would just. Shall I chant the verse? Okay. Time. Okay, so I won't chant the verse actually. But I thought I would read from Srimad Bhagavatam, from the third canto, chapter 2, Remembrance of Lord Krishna. And of course, today on Janmashtami, that's exactly the meditation for all of us, is to try to remember Lord Krishna and Lord Krishna's activities. And in this particular section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that's exactly what the inhabitants of Vrindavan are doing. They're remembering Lord Krishna. So Lord Krishna, all his friends, all his associates, all his family, they're remembering him. Okay, so I'll just chant the verse because we don't have as much time as maybe we would like or otherwise. Okay. Komarim dashayam chestam prekshaniyam vrajokasham rudani vahasan mudha balasim havalokana. Translation. When the Lord displayed his activities just suitable for childhood, he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan. Sometimes he would cry and sometimes laugh, just like a child, and while doing so, he would appear like a lion cub. Purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. If anyone wants to enjoy the childhood pastimes of the Lord, then he has to follow in the footsteps of the residents of Vraj, like Nanda, Upananda, and other parental inhabitants. A child may insist on having something and cry like anything to get it, disturbing the whole neighborhood. Yeah. And then immediately after achieving the desired thing, he laughs. Such crying and laughing is enjoyable to the parents and elderly members of the family. Okay. Sounds like you have children. Such crying and laughing is enjoyable to the parents and elderly members of the family. So the Lord would simultaneously cry and laugh in this way and merge his devotee parents in the humor of transcendental pleasure. These incidents are enjoyable only by the residents of Raj, like Nanda Maharaj, and not by the impersonalist worshippers of Brahman and Paramatma. Sometimes, when attacked in the forest by demons, Krishna would appear struck with wonder, but he looked on them like the cub of a lion and killed them. His childhood companions would also be struck with wonder. And when they came back home, they would narrate the story to their parents and everyone would appreciate the qualities of their Krishna. Child Krishna did not belong only to his parents, Nanda and Yashoda. He was the son of all the elderly inhabitants of Vrindavan and the friend of all contemporary boys and girls. Everyone loved Krishna. He was the life and soul of everyone, including the animals, the cows and the calves. read the translation one more time. When the Lord displayed his activities just suitable for childhood, he was visible only to the residents of Vrindavan. Sometimes he would cry and sometimes laugh, just like a child. And while doing so, he would appear like a lion cub. On this wonderful day of Janmashtami, when we celebrate the appearance of Lord Krishna and read pastimes like this. Actually, while reading the purport, the reason that I was chuckling, and others seem to be chuckling too, is, like Nanda Maharaj, I'm also a father and have two children, two boys. And I can remember when they were in the coma room phase of their life. I think that's between 0 and 5. I can remember them doing exactly that. I can remember them insisting on having something and crying like anything to get it. And you know, it's quite an amazing thing. They cry. They don't just cry. They start off crying. And when you don't respond, when you don't reciprocate with what they want, then they tend to lie on their backs. And they continue crying while they're lying on their back. And then they tend to stick their feet in the air, like that, and cry louder and louder and louder. And then, when you still don't reciprocate, this is when I was on my own with my children. If my wife was with me, she would reciprocate very quickly. You know, they got instant reciprocation. They just had to whimper and they got what they wanted. But with me, my false ego got involved. And I thought, hey, you know, I'm not giving in to them so easily. So they have to lie on their back, stick their feet, and cry. And then what they do is they get to the point where they start to choke. I'm convinced they probably don't, you know, they're probably not completely conscious that they're doing that, but definitely it's a subconscious thing. And next thing they're going like this, they're crying, and then it's like, and then even a hard-hearted father like me has to actually think, ooh. That sounds a little dangerous. Maybe I should do something now. And then you would reciprocate and give them whatever they wanted, whatever it was that they wanted at the time. I can't remember so many things that they would want. But then, exactly as this purport says, even they look like they're about to die, they're about to leave their body with the choking. As soon as you give them what they want, they're instantaneously they're all okay again, and they're up and they're happy and they've got a big smile on their face, etc., etc. So definitely I can reciprocate with what this purport is talking about. However, what I cannot reciprocate with or not understand is his devotee parents in the humor of transcendental pleasure. These incidents were so enjoyable by the residents of Vraj. That I couldn't really relate to, the transcendental pleasure. I didn't particularly get transcendental pleasure from that particular activities. But then I can understand that, you know, what's being talked about in this purport is you have to be in that mood. You have to be, you know, in that devotional mood, that complete devotional mood, to be able to experience that transcendental pleasure that the devotees of Vrindavan, that it's been expressed in this particular verse. And then they talk about here, it says that they would come home and narrate the stories of their parents, whatever the story would be, Krishna killing some demon, etc. And everyone would appreciate the qualities of Krishna. Child Krishna did not only belong to his parents, he was the son of all the elderly inhabitants of Vrindavan and the friend of all contemporary boys and girls. And it says there that he was their Krishna. He was their Krishna. So he wasn't just Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj's Krishna. He was everyone's Krishna in Vrindavan. He was their Krishna. So, and then it goes on to say that he was the life and soul of everyone. There's a phrase in English, I'm sure you're probably familiar with it, being the life and the soul of the party, like that. Someone is the life and the soul of the party. And when you read these purports, you can see that somebody who wants to be, maybe all of us at one point in time have experienced that desire to be the life and soul of the party, that really it's an anarta or an unwanted thing that we have in our heart, that we want that, because Krishna is actually the life and soul, not just of the party, but the life and soul of everyone, as it's stated here. And as long as we are wanting to be the life and soul of something, whatever it may be, that disqualifies us from, if you like, owning Krishna, or Krishna being ours. Here it said that they're Krishna, so they own Krishna. But as long as we have those desires to experience and enjoy separately from Krishna, then it's difficult or it's impossible for us to be to own Krishna and for Krishna to be ours. And Prabhupada expresses here in the purport that these incidents are enjoyable only by the residents of Raj and not by the impersonalist worshippers of Brahman and Paramatma. So to whatever degree we're wanting to enjoy this creation of Krishna, because ultimately everything in this material world is coming from the energy of Krishna, it's all ultimately created by Krishna indirectly. And as long as we're wanting that, wanting to own some of that, wanting to enjoy some of that, separately from the owner of that, then we fall into this category, to varying degrees, we fall into this category of being impersonalists like that. And as a result, that's why we're in the material world, that's why we've come here, because that's what we wanted to do. And when we're here, the whole idea, and now that we've all come into Krishna's temple, is to extract ourselves from that scenario that we have entered into, wanting to have something separately or enjoy separately from Krishna, so as that we can get to the point of it being our Krishna, if you like, us owning Krishna almost. And that's what happens here with the residents of Vrindavan. Krishna is, we understand that, Krishna is completely indebted to the residents of Vrindavan. So that's the stage or the position that we want to come to, we want to return to, because we understand that we haven't been in that position previously. So what's actually stopping us from doing that? Today, again, as we know, is Janmashtami, the appearance of Lord Krishna. And Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita, Janma Karma Chame Divyam, that if one understands, if we actually understand, later in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also speaks the verse, Raja Vija Raja Guyam, that this is this knowledge, it's the king of education, it's the highest of knowledge, because it gives direct perception of who we are. Not by just reading, not by somebody telling us. You can remember in school the teacher, beating you over the head to remember things and to understand things like that. But it's not by that process. The process is that it gives direct perception of who we are by realization. We realize it. We don't need someone to tell us. We don't need to read it. We actually realize it. Probably gives a nice example. When you're hungry, and you're really hungry, you tend to be quite conscious of that. How many people have ever been hungry in their lives? I know in our modern society, one of the problems is people don't experience hunger anymore, and that's why we're all overweight and suffering so many health problems. But actually, it's healthy to be hungry sometimes. But I'm sure you've all experienced hunger for whatever reason. And when you're really, really hungry, it really plays on your mind. You think, God, I'm starving. I really need to eat something. And you start to try and figure out how you're going to solve this problem of your hunger, whatever possible way you can do that. But as soon as you do solve that problem, as soon as you eat something like that, soon, like today, you're all probably hungry. You're all probably quite hungry right now, actually. Just don't. So, yeah. a sadist or a masochist, I never know the difference between the two, but I'm being one of them. Anyway, we're all hungry. Now, when we honour prasadam at midnight or 12:30, or usually the temple president, he likes to enjoy a little bit, so he pushes it through to 1 o'clock or whatever time, 1:30. Anyway, when you honour prasadam later on this evening, you don't need me or anybody else to tell you that you're satisfied. You'll know that you're satisfied like that. So it's the same about understanding who we are. It's by direct perception that we understand who we are. So, not Raja Vijaya, sorry, Janma Karma Chame Divyam. In the same way, when we understand the transcendental nature of Krishna's appearance and activities, when we actually understand that by direct perception, then we can go back and we can be one of the residents of Vrindavan, and we can enjoy these incredible pastimes with Krishna when we actually understand that. And Prabhupada explains that Krishna's not Niskriya. He's not without activities. He has activities. Constantly he's engaged in activities. Why? Why is he engaged in activities? Because he's a person, just like we're all persons, and we engage in activities. Every single day, every moment of every day, we are engaged in some kind of activity. So Krishna's no different than us. He's engaged in all of these activities like that. Of course, these activities are transcendental. So when we come to understand that, then we can associate very closely in an intimate relationship with Krishna. So what's stopping us from doing that? What's actually stopping us from doing that right now? We all understand. Janet Iper was giving out the Bhakti Shastri certificates earlier. So anybody who's read Bhagavad Gita will understand that Krishna is dwelling within our hearts. Every single one of us, Krishna is in our heart. He's right beside us. So what's stopping us from turning to Krishna and associating intimately with him? What's actually stopping us from doing that? Actually, Krishna's amazing, because no matter where we journey in the material world, and, you know, none of us know how many existences we've had in this material world. Literally, it can be unlimited. Billions and billions and billions of existences we may have had in this material world. And also where we are now, particularly sitting here in the ISKCON London temple, it's a pretty nice situation that we're in. But we are likely to have been, and if we're not careful, we can also in the future go to some extraordinarily difficult situations. Actually, we're sitting here, it's very, very nice on Janmashtami, but this material world is a difficult place. It's a difficult place to exist in. And all the difficulties that we have to go through, at the end of them all, we have to actually leave this body. It's a challenge. We're in a real challenging situation. However, the amazing thing is, no matter where we've been in this material existence, and no matter where we find ourselves going in the future, Krishna is so merciful. He travels with us as Paramatma in our hearts. Every living entity, from a one-cell amoeba up to a demigod, Krishna will travel with us as Paramatma in our heart because he's so caring, loving, and merciful to us. All of us will know, again in English we have these phrases like, oh, my best friend. But just like Narada is the best devotee, Radharani is the best devotee, Prahlad is the best devotee. When you have more than one best friend, how can they be the best? Because you've got a bit of a problem, because best means it's just that one person. So as we expand our circle of best friends, we start to get into a more intimate situation. I think the phrase we use is, these are my best friends, but then I have my bestest friend. You know, and you start to qualify it like that. But all of us probably have this experience, whether it's our best friend or our bestest friend, we probably all have this experience in this lifetime of one of those actually letting us down, which is quite a crushing thing when someone that you consider so close and so dear and so loving and supportive lets you down. It can be quite a crushing thing, and I think we've probably all had that experience of being let down by a dear friend, by a close friend. Krishna never does that. Never, in any given situation. He never lets us down. He never abandons us, never deserts us like that. Always stays with us and is always just waiting for us to turn to him and ask him for help. And as soon as we do that, he will be there to give us all the help that we need. So why don't we do that? What is it that's stopping us from actually doing that? I was reading recently, it was a lecture that Srila Prabhupada was given, but I was actually reading it. And Prabhupada was explaining, and my understanding of what he was explaining, if I put it in my own words, was that he was explaining that the reason we don't do that, or the big obstacle, the big blockage, the thing that is actually stopping us from doing that, is that we are afraid. And what is it that we're afraid of? We have a real fear, a real anxiety, paranoia, and we're afraid to accept that we're a person. We're afraid to accept that we are a person. And that's the basis and the basic aspect of Krishna conscious philosophy or theology, that we are eternal persons. every single one of us sitting in this room, everything that is born, that grows, that produces byproducts, that remains the same for some time, that dwindles and ultimately dies, every material creature that goes through those six phases is an eternal spirit soul. And as an eternal spirit soul, we have an eternal personality, and we also, of course, have an eternal relationship with the Supreme Person. But we are an eternal personality, meaning that we are an eternal person. But the thing that stops us from turning to Krishna, who's sitting in our heart right now, the big obstacle is we are afraid to acknowledge that we are an eternal person. We're afraid to do that. And why are we afraid to do that? Why are we afraid to accept that we're an eternal person? So Prabhupada further explains that Prakrite Kriyamanani, that he explains that since time immemorial, since we've been in this material world, since time immemorial, we have been preached to. There is something that is preaching to us. Every moment of every day, we are being preached to, and the preaching that we're receiving is that we are not an eternal person. We are this body. That's the preaching that we're receiving at all times. And you know, sometimes, you know, at a public program, whether it be a Sunday feast or some festival devotees arrange, you may meet people who don't know so much about Krishna, and you may start to talk to them. And they may be quite challenging. They may not accept, you know, spiritual life, may not accept that there's an eternal person, may not accept that they're eternal. And what do? You engage in a discussion with them on the basis of logic, reason, and argument, and you try to actually convince them that yes, you are an eternal person, and yes, there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that exercise that we engage in with another person, we have to also engage in that exercise with ourselves all the time, because constantly we're being preached to that we are not an eternal person, we are this temporary material body. And what is it that's preaching to us? Who is it that's preaching to us that that's what we are? It's our false ego, as we also learn from Bhagavad Gita, that is constantly preaching that to us. But we've got to overcome our false ego. We've got to defeat the false ego and convince ourselves that actually we're an eternal person. Because only when we do that can we start to engage and have an eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Later on in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Makchitarsava Durgani verse, in the 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that if we don't do this, and if we surrender to, or give in to, or allow our false ego to dictate to us, if we actually allow that to happen, he says we will be lost. Pardon? Can I repeat? Okay. I'm just talking about us being the importance of us defeating our false ego, overcoming our false ego, because the false ego is telling us that we're this temporary body. That's what the false ego is telling us constantly. We are the mind and we're the body, and just simply enjoy the mind, enjoy the senses. But we have to overcome that. But if we don't do that, Krishna says in the Makchitarsava Durgani verse, that if we don't overcome our false ego, that we will be lost. If we surrender to our false ego, we will be lost like that. And what does being lost mean? What does that actually mean? It means that we are going to travel eternally in this material realm, in this material universe, constantly travel, denying and ignoring Krishna as Paramatma in our hearts. And that's what being lost means, this eternal journey in the material world. It's called that Nityabandha, being eternally conditioned in this material world. So it's so important. And then when we do overcome the false ego, the prize, not that we're necessarily looking for prizes, although we saw tonight that people are getting prizes for passing their Bhakti Shastri, so you know, we can get little motivating things. But the prize for overcoming our false ego is that we can have an eternal relationship with Krishna. And because this is Janmashtami, it's nice to talk about Krishna's pastimes. Of course, you know, we always have to be a little careful when we're discussing Krishna's pastimes, because two things. One is, it's important that we don't take them cheaply. When we're living in the material world and associating with the material energy, it's very, very important that we don't do that, take Krishna's pastimes cheaply. And also, not so much for devotees, but certainly there's also a tendency for the impersonalists, etc., people absorbed in material consciousness, there's also a tendency for us to disbelieve, to actually doubt. In fact, when the British went to India all those centuries ago, they sent different sociologists, different people who were, you know, kind of so-called experts on how society works and social nature of people and how they interact, etc. Is that already the time? Wow, what do I do? Okay. Anyway, they had these people in India, English, British people. And the idea was they were to study Indian society, Indian culture, and figure out, you know, how best to defeat so that the British could actually conquer and control India. And they studied for many years, for 5, 10, 15 years like that, and these people came back. And what they said was, two things they said, to control and dominate Indian society. One was to convince the Brahmins, or the teachers, the priests, etc., to convince them to take a wage. Convince them to accept money for their services. If you do that, that will destroy the Brahminical class, the educated class, the intelligence, and that will help you control society. And the other thing was, convince them that the pastimes of Krishna, as explained in Mahabharata and Srimad Bhagavatam, etc., convince them that they're mythology. And if you do those two things, get the Brahmins to accept a wage and convince people that this is all mythology, then you will be able to dominate and dictate like that. So those two things, it's important that you know, that we don't take these pastimes of Krishna cheaply, but also that we obviously don't get into the scenario of thinking somehow or other that they're fabricated like that. So I would like to just give one pastime, because it's Janmashtami. And this pastime is referred to in the Nectar of Devotion, and it's further elaborated by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And it just goes to show how wonderful Krishna is. Right now, in London, as I understand it, there's a certain thing happening. I know you're probably not aware of it, but it's a thing called, something called the Olympics, isn't it?
Olympics.
Oh, that's next year. Okay. So that's happening in London. And the funny thing is, and you have all these quote-unquote, you know, superstars who win the gold medal, etc., you know, and everyone thinks they're wonderful. If Krishna was here, the Olympics would be very boring. Because Krishna would win the gold medal in every sport that they have. And how many sports they have. But he would win the gold medal. And why it would be really boring would be he wouldn't only win the gold medal, but he'd win the silver and the bronze too. Because he's such an incredible guy, you know. And the thing is, that's what we're all here for. We're all here trying to be Krishna. And it's like we can't be. So, you know, whether it's... my memory goes back to people like Daley Thompson and people like that, you know, I don't know all the modern guys. But whoever they are trying to win these medals, everyone is wanting to be a little bit of Krishna, to be the hero for some time like that. So anyway, Krishna, here's a pastime. One time, Radharani and her friends, her gopi friends, they decided during the cold month of January and February, they decided to perform a little austerity. And what they decided to do was every morning they would go to the river Yamuna and they would take bath. I've actually just come back from India. I'm literally back about 48 hours. And, you know, anytime I go to India, I cannot relate when people say, you know, about performing austerity, go take a bath in the river. It's just such a pleasure. I mean, you know, when you're getting up for Mangal Aarti, you know, you can't wait to have a cold shower. You know, a cold shower is actually enjoyment. It's not an austerity at all. But anyway, I suppose the people who are more used to that temperature, you know, 40 degrees and 90% humidity, people who are used to that, maybe taking a cold shower is an austerity. So anyway, Radharani and her friends, they decided that they would go to the Yamuna every morning for the month of January and February and take a bath in the Yamuna because that's the cold time of the year. So, somehow or another, this came to the attention of Kutila. Do we all know who Kutila is? Kutila, huh? No, okay. Kutila is the sister of Abhimanyu, and Abhimanyu is the husband of Radharani. Okay? So, and Kutila is described, it's interesting, when I was reading this pastime, I could immediately relate to it, because Kutila is described as being dull-headed and crooked. I thought, yeah, well, I can relate to being crooked. Again, you know, if we weren't crooked, if we didn't have some little bit of crookedness to us, we wouldn't have come to the material world. So we all have a little bit of crookedness to us. Anyway, Kutila is described as being crooked and dull-headed. When she got to learn that Radha was going to take bath early in the morning in the Yamuna, she became suspicious. Oh, why is she going to take bath in the Yamuna? So what she did was, one morning, she went to Nandagram, to Krishna's home, and she wanted to know what Krishna was doing at this time in the morning. And she went, and Krishna wasn't anywhere to be found, so she asked somebody, oh, where's Krishna, what's he doing? And the person told her, said, oh, Krishna, oh, this is the month of January and February, Krishna's performing a vrat, or he's performing some austerity, and he's taking bath early in the morning in the Yamuna. And when Kutila heard this, then, whoa, this, now she put two and two together, and of course, well, maybe she did get four. Is actually, putting two and two together and getting four isn't always the case. It's an interesting thing. The material world is a very complex place to actually exist in. And we should never jump to conclusions. Or if we do find ourselves jumping to conclusions, we should quickly jump back again and just try to have another fresh look at the situation, because sometimes we can get into trouble by jumping to conclusions. And I'm going to divert here a little bit. I remember when I was a little kid, I think I was 5 or 6, and it was my birthday. And on my birthday, my mother used to get this big cake, you know, it was a 3-layered cake, and it was sponge, you know, sugary sponge. And in between each layer, there was a big thick layer of cream and jam in each layer like that. So the highlight of the birthday party, I'd invite all my friends around. Actually, you know, they wouldn't have come if it wasn't a birthday cake. They didn't come for my birthday, they just came because they knew there would be a wonderful cake to eat. Anyway, I felt good because I at that time I wasn't thinking like that. I was thinking I'm really popular and they're all coming because they think I'm a wonderful guy, but actually later on I figured out they were just coming for the cake. Anyway, so the cake was there. And this was, we had the cake and wonderful sponge, oh, lovely, lovely jam, cream, you know, sponge, sugar, da, da, da. Absolute lovely experience. Next day, I was in school. And then we used to just do maths and English, we used to just do in school. But every now and again, the teacher would do a little history or a little geography. And that day, for whatever reason, our teacher, her name was Mrs. Burnhoop, and she decided to do a little bit of geography. Okay, and she started talking about sponges in the sea. And I was thinking, why would anybody want to put a sponge in the sea? You know, it would get all soggy and salty and it would be just horrible. You know, why would you do that? Why would you put a sponge in the sea? And I just couldn't figure out what she was talking about or why she was talking about. And I don't know how long I held that thought for, but it was probably a year, maybe 2 years. I wasn't thinking about it every single day. But, you know, any time it would come into my mind, I would think, yeah, why would you put a sponge in the sea? Anyway, a couple of years later, when I was 7, 8, or 9, whatever it was, I came home from school one day, and my brother was sitting in front of the television, and he was watching a program on the television. And you're probably not old enough for this, but it was called, the program he was watching was called The Wonderful World of Jacques Cousteau. Yes. Hey, you must be at least 45.
Thank you. I'm 45.
Yeah, no, you look about 55, but I'm just saying you must be at least 45. Okay.
I'm 25, really.
The Wonderful World of Jacques Cousteau, okay? Jacques was a Frenchman. But, anyway, and what was Jacques doing? He was under the sea, and he had his thing on his back, you know, and his breathing apparatus, and he was going around, and he had a mic. It was, you know, now, of course, they have so much technology, but in those days, it was amazing, a guy under the sea, and you could hear him speaking, and it was, wow, how can he speak from under the sea? Anyway, he was doing that, and he was talking, what was he talking about? Sponges. And I thought, wow, that's what my teacher was talking about all those years ago. She was talking about sponges under the sea. So, we should never jump to conclusions. I immediately jumped to the conclusion about sponges in the sea being my birthday cake under the sea, and I just couldn't figure it out. So jumping to conclusions is always a bad idea. Anyway, Kutila, she immediately jumped to the conclusion that Krishna and Radha, both going to the Yamuna to take a bath in the early morning, they're up to no good. So she decided she would go and try and find them. And of course, Krishna and Radha were together, enjoying these blissful pastimes that we talk about or we read about in the Srimad Bhagavatam, that we're only qualified to actually engage in and experience if we're pure in heart. That's the qualification. So Krishna and Radha were engaging in these wonderful pastimes, and Kutila was after them. She wanted to find them because she was the sister of Abhimanyu, who was the husband of Radharani, and she wanted to get on Radha's case for having this relationship with another man, Krishna. Krishna's not just another man, of course, he's Krishna. Anyway, she was after them. And one of Radha's friends, Tulsi Devi, she saw Kutila coming. Krishna and Radha and her friends were in like a forest house. You know, when you were a kid, maybe when you were a kid, I don't know. We used to build these hideouts. We used to make them from branches of trees and all that kind of thing. So these were the kind of things that they had in the forests of Vrindavan. They had like forest houses. And Radha and Krishna were in there with their friends, and they were laughing and joking and having a great time. But then Tulsi saw Kutila coming, and they all knew Kutila. Kutila, you know, I'm being unfair now, but Kutila, she's like the kind of Hiranyakashipu of Krishna's pastimes. You know, she's like of Krishna's Raj pastimes. She's the bad kind of... the bad guy, like that. So Tulsi saw Kutila coming, and she ran into the forest house. She ran to the forest house and ran into the forest house, and she said, "Oh, Haribo, 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 Kutila's coming. And all the gopis freaked out. "Oh, what am I going to do? Kutila's coming. She'll find us, and she'll get on our case, and she'll this, that, and the other." So Krishna stands up and says, Don't worry. I've got a solution. He says, "What I will do is I will transform myself into Abhimanyu. And that will trick Kutila. She will think I'm Abhimanyu, I'm her brother." So Krishna left the forest house, and as he was leaving, he turned himself into Abhimanyu in terms of his clothes and everything else. A little bit like, you know, you see in these superhero movies, you know, Superman, Clark Kent goes into the phone box, spins around and becomes Superman. So Krishna, as he was walking out of the forest house, he turned himself into Abhimanyu. And he walked towards where Kutila was coming. And when he bumped into Kutila, when Kutila saw him coming, she said, "Ah, Abhimanyu, what are you doing here?" And Abhimanyu says, "Oh, well, what I'm doing here is that yesterday, when I was training one of our bulls, one of our bullocks, he escaped, and I'm looking for that bull. He's somewhere around here. I'm trying to find him. So that's what I'm doing here. What are you doing here?" And Kutila says, "Oh, I'm looking for your wife, Radharani. I want to know what she's doing. I have my suspicion that she's up to no good with that Krishna." And Abhimanyu says, "Wow." He says, "As much as I'm depressed about losing the bull, if my wife is up to no good with Krishna, that's even more depressing for me. Yes, please try." Now, remember, this isn't Abhimanyu. This is Krishna pretending to be Abhimanyu. And he says, "Yes, please try and find out what's going on," like that. "So I'll wait here," and he pointed to where he would wait. "You go and see if you can find them and come back and give me a report. Tell me what's happening." So Kutila goes, and she comes across this forest house. She sees Radha there, and she sees Lalita, and she thinks, now I found them. So she goes and talks to them, and then Lalita says, "What are you doing here, Kutila? Have you come to bathe in the Yamuna early in the morning and join us in our vrat or in our austerity?" And Kutila says, "No, I haven't. I've come to find out what's going on. I know that you're up to no good." And she said, "I want to go into that forest house. I want to know what's going on in there. So please let me in." And Lalita says, "How can I let you in? It's not our home. The door is locked. You know, I cannot let you into somebody else's house." And then Kutila says, "Oh, really? You can't, really? Well, you're very good at letting other people into other people's houses." Now she's referring to letting Krishna into Radha's house. "You're very good at doing that, so why can't I go in there?" Anyway, Lalita's not giving in, and eventually Kutila bursts into the forest house. And when she bursts in, she sees a garland that she assumes belongs to Krishna, and she sees a necklace that she assumes belongs to Radha. And she takes them out, and she accuses Radharani, "You know, this is Krishna's, this is yours, what's going on?" And Radharani says, "No, you're wrong, these aren't mine, they're nothing to do with me." So anyway, Kutila goes back then to who she thinks is Abhimanyu, but of course it's not Abhimanyu, it's actually Krishna. And she goes back and she produces this necklace and also this garland. And she says, look, evidence. Look, I've caught them. This is Krishna's. This is Radha's. You know, look. Whatever. So Abhimanyu, who's actually Krishna, says, oh, and he's pretending to be all distraught and upset. And he says, yes, give me those. What I'm going to do with them is I'm going to bring them to Mathura, and I'm going to bring them to Kamsa, and I'm going to tell Kamsa, look what's going on in Vrindavan. You have to sort this out. This rascal Krishna, who, of course, you know, Krishna knew that Kamsa didn't particularly like Krishna, as we all know. Kamsa had a bit of a complex about Krishna. he wanted rid of him. So he knew this would be music to Kamsa's ears. Look what this guy Krishna is doing. You must send your army to Vrindavan and arrest this guy Krishna, because he's degrading and he's contaminating all the women of Vrindavan. So please come quickly and do this. So Abhimanyu, who was actually Krishna, says, okay, that's what I will do. Now, Kutila, one thing is that to preserve the reputation of our family, I'm going to go and do this and get Kamsa to come with his army and arrest Krishna. But don't tell anybody about this, because, you know, we don't want the gossip going all around Vrindavan. And if you do anyway, not only will that happen, but also Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda will get to hear about it, and they'll come and take Krishna, and they'll escape before Kamsa comes. So please, don't tell anybody about this. Let Kamsa just come and his army come and arrest Krishna, and that'll solve the problem. So Kutila says, okay, fantastic, that's what I'll do. And he says, now you go home, Kutila, you go home, and go back to your mother, you know, Jatila, and you wait for me. I'll be coming home. As soon as I've informed Kamsa, I will then come home, like that. So, of course, this is Krishna. He doesn't go and inform Kamsa at all, he pretends. So then, about a couple of hours later, after pretending that he's informed Kamsa, Abhimanyu, who's actually Krishna, we're all following this now, right? We're not lost here, right? Because I know when I read it the first time, I was thinking, wow, that's pretty complicated kind of story. So Abhimanyu, who's actually Krishna, he comes back and he says, okay, Kamsa, back to his house. And in the house, Kutila's in the house with her mother, okay? And at this stage, Radha has also come back from her morning bath, and she's back in her home, which is that home, because she's the wife of Abhimanyu. So Abhimanyu, who's actually Krishna, says to Kutila and Jatila, he says, and Radharani, of course, knows that it's Krishna, and he says, Kamsa's on his way. He's on his way. Now, Krishna is also on his way here. However, he's playing a trick. This Krishna is so crafty and so devious and so crooked. He's playing a trick. He's pretending to be me. He's pretending to be Abhimanyu. So don't be fooled by this. When he comes, both of you should be sitting or standing on the balcony of the house. You should get yourself a whole supply of mud balls, dry mud, you know, that they're wet and then dry them, but a whole supply of mud balls, so you have like loads of them, you know. And as soon as you see him, as soon as you see me, it won't be me, this is me, and it's not me, that was, it was actually Krishna, but as soon as you see me, it won't actually be me, it'll be Krishna pretending to be me. Once you see him, just pelt him as much as you can with these mud balls. In the meantime, I'm going into the inner sanctum of the house with my wife, Radha, because Radha has to be protected, because she's a little weak-minded, and as soon as she sees or smells or has any sense that Krishna's around, she gets all delusional and all illusional, and, you know, and she gets all, you know, dizzy-headed, you know, all that kind of thing, and she becomes attracted to Krishna. So I'm going to bring her, as her husband, and it wasn't her husband, it was actually Krishna, I'm going to bring her into the inner sanctum of the house to protect her from this rascal Krishna who's on his way dressed as me, pretending to be me. So he did. He went into the inner sanctum of the house. And what did he do in the inner sanctum of the house? He engaged in the very pastimes at Radharani that he was engaging in with her in the forest house when Kutila came and disturbed them. So now they went from the forest house into Kutila's own house. This was Kutila's house, and now they were engaged in these very same... She was trying to put a stop to these pastimes, and that's why she went to the forest early in the morning. And now Krishna, through his craftiness, has now managed to get himself back with Radharani and into Kutila's actual very house. not only into Kutila's house, but he has Kutila and her mother protecting them from the outside, protecting them from Abhimanyu. Because he's about to come, and they're convinced that they're already convinced it's not Abhimanyu, it's actually Krishna dressed as Abhimanyu, when Krishna, the real Krishna, is actually in their house. So what happens? Abhimanyu comes back from his day of herding the cows and looking after the cows. Abhimanyu comes, and as soon as they see him, Kutila starts shouting all this abuse at him. I know who you are. You're not my brother. You're that rascal Krishna. Well, take this. And they start pelting him with these mud balls like this. And Abhimanyu, it is Abhimanyu, you know, it's not Krishna. Abhimanyu, wow, what's going on here? And he concludes that his sister and his mother have been somehow or another overtaken by some ghosts. And he decides, wow, this is really weird. He decides, I better go into the village of Vrindavan and get one of the brahmanas who's expert at exorcising people from getting rid of ghosts out of their systems. I better go in and get one of the brahmins and bring the brahmin to our house to actually exorcise my sister and my mother from the ghosts that have overtaken them. So he goes off and does that. And Kutila and Jatila, mother and daughter, they stay protecting on the balcony, protecting the house while Krishna's inside, dressed, pretending to be Abhimanyu Radha, and they're protecting them, and they're having their pastimes in perfect peace and perfect quiet with the very person who was trying to put a stop to those pastimes, protecting them like that. Isn't that a wonderful pastime? Amazing pastime. And that's why, as I said, if Krishna was in London today, and of course he is in London today, he's on the altar here with us, but if he was in the East End of London today, he'd be winning, you know, the 10,000 metres or the 100 metres or whatever. He'd be winning the gold, silver and bronze because he's such a wonderful personality. Okay, fantastic. I've gone over time, and I apologise for that. Yes. So now, what's the next part of the programme, Jai Tagram? Aarti, let's finish.
Hare Krishna.
Okay. So, we now go to the next part of the program, which is the Abhishek. And after that, I do believe, because I saw them earlier when I was when I first arrived, we have some drama. 9 o'clock is the drama.